ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Gigantic garland. Who made this one?
Pura Mataji.
Huh?
Pura
Mataji. Yeah. Two days worth of flowers in one day. So we're going to be two verses this morning, continuing the topic for those that were with us yesterday. The topic is Kardama Muni is offering prayers to Lord Kapila Dev. And the timing of this is nine daughters were born from Kardama Muni and Devahuti. Lord Brahma came and prayers were offered to Lord Brahma, father of Kardama Muni. And different exchanges, and Kardama Muni was told these nine daughters can be given to as wives to the others who have become Prajapatis. Now, this function of populating the universe with good offspring. And Brahma said that within the womb of Devahuti is a form of the Lord. So now it's like public information, no question about it. And everybody, the marriages were done, and everybody went here and there. Discussion about the appearance of Kapila Dev. He grew and now he's mature in age and in a secluded place, so it's just the two of them. There's no others hearing the discussion. Kardama Muni is speaking to Kapila Dev. And yesterday we discussed the first three verses of his presentation, honoring his position, and the process of bhakti, to understand him, to be in a relationship with him, etc. So Kardama Muni is continuing text 30, chapter 24. Remember, he's speaking to his son, and he's addressing him as, my dear Lord. He's not unclear that because previously Lord Vishnu appeared when Kardama, before this marriage, and said, I'll appear as your son, so now he's appeared as his son. He knows his son is the Supreme Lord. You, my dear Lord, are always increasing the honor of your devotees. Having descended in my home, just to fulfill your word, which was previously given in a long, long ago, because with Devahuti, much time passed of their performing austerities together and performing the meditation process of Santa Yuga and etc., etc. So he's fulfilled his word, I will appear as your son. You have descended in my home just to fulfill your word and to disseminate the process of real knowledge. Now, from Bhagavad Gita, we know one of the purposes of the Lord's appearance is to give knowledge. Dharma sangstha panartaya. The means of connecting with the personality of God. This knowledge, sankhya, philosophy, in the case of Kapiladeva, is going to be taught. So he knows you come to give this transcendental knowledge, disseminate the process of real knowledge. Purport. When the Lord appeared before Kardamoni, after his, that's Kardamoni's mature yoga practice, he, Supreme Lord, promised that he would become Kardama's son. He descended as the son of Kardamuni in order to fulfill that promise. Another purpose of his appearance is, from the Sanskrit of the verse, Chikirshur Bhagavan Gyanam. Chikirshur Bhagavan Gyanam, to distribute knowledge. Therefore, the last line of the verse, Bhaktanam Mana Vardhana. He who increases the honor of his devotees. Bhaktanam Mana Vardhanaha. Mana is translated, the word for word is honor. By distributing Sankhya, he would increase the honor of the devotees. Therefore, Sankhya philosophy is not dry mental speculation. Sankhya philosophy means devotional service. How could the honor of the devotees be increased unless Sankhya were meant for devotional service? It's a logical argument. He didn't come to give impersonalism and thus increase the fame of his devotee father, Kardama. Devotees are not interested in speculative knowledge, semicolon. Therefore, the Sankhya enunciated by Kapila Muni is meant to establish one firmly in devotional service. Real knowledge and real liberation is to surrender unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead and engage in devotional service. So this bhaktanam manavardhanaha. So that the fame, let's say it conversely, it's just a logical statement in Prabhupada's purport, but if Kapiladeva's purpose was to teach impersonalism, it wouldn't give honor to the devotees who don't teach impersonalism. But the teaching of Kapila, the Sankhya philosophy of Kapila, is devotion. So let's go back three giant steps. This is chapter 24. Chapter 25 is devotional service. That's the title, devotional service. Well, it's between here and then the end of 24, Kardama Muni takes permission from his son, the Supreme Lord, who is his son, to go to the forest and continue his practice of meditation. So we have three different processes: Sankhya philosophy, meditation, and bhakti. How do they connect? When Devahuti, at the beginning of chapter 25, is feeling pain of separation from her husband, who she's been with for tens of thousands of years in a blissful, happy marriage. No quarrels. Blissful, happy marriage for tens of thousands of years, imagine. And so she's feeling bereft of his association. She's feeling very sad because he's gone. And she turns to her son, who she knows is also has the personality of Godhead, and says, "Help! How do I get over this grief of separation?" And his answer is bhakti. Now, the whole of chapter 25 is bhakti, is devotional service. Following 25 is 26, and 26 is all about Sankhya philosophy. So Kapila Dev is renowned for delivering Sankhya philosophy. When you hear Kapila Dev, Sankhya philosophy, just like the bell rings. Sankhya philosophy. But where does Sankhya philosophy take you? According to... Sure. According to... According to, there's a sequence, it goes like this, keeping it simple. In 26, he teaches Sankhya, how matter evolves. And at the end of that, you know, all the different elements come out. And at the end of that, he says, at the end of chapter 26, all this Sankhya philosophy is then meant to turn one to the stage of meditation, because it's satyuga, and dhyan, or meditation, is the means of achieving perfection in satyuga, right? Meditation. But meditation on what? You have to have a philosophy. So Sankhya precedes the meditation, and then the meditation leads to bhakti. Okay. Meditation leads to bhakti. Proper meditation leads to bhakti. And proper philosophy leads to meditation on something that's spiritual. That leads to bhakti. So we have three processes. Philosophy, meditation, and bhakti. And one leads to the next, leads to the next. So Kapila Dev doesn't just teach philosophy. He teaches bhakti. Not just Sankhya philosophy. Sankhya philosophy, but it leads to meditation, leads to bhakti. Meditation leads to bhakti. Philosophy leads to meditation, leads to bhakti. The goal is knowing the personality of Godhead, who can only be known through bhakti. Not just by philosophy or by meditation. Yes? It's clear? Clear? Okay, good. So, the point that's being made in the purport is that the process, you haven't, so Kardama's saying you've appeared to fulfill your promise, and you've appeared to disseminate the process of real knowledge, which leads to meditation, which leads to devotion. Not, you know, process of knowledge, full stop. And the process of knowledge, full stop, is misleading senses, you become one with the Supreme. You understand your identity. This is the false Kapila. came much later and taught a false impersonal Sankhya philosophy that leads to, notionally at least, becoming one with Brahman. Merging. Impersonalism. Not Devahuti Putra, or here, Kalma Muni Putra Kapila. You come to disseminate real knowledge that leads to devotion. Because it's only by devotion that he can be understood. So he's a devotee, he knows this. Kanha is not just a philosopher impersonalist, he's a devotee. He has philosophy, he has mystic yoga. Perfect in his process of meditation and a pure devotee. And for this reason, Kapila has agreed to appear as his son. So, I read over the middle section of the purport. The Prabhupada is touching on this point. Another purpose of his appearance is Chikishur Bhagavan Gyanam, to distribute knowledge. Therefore, he is called Bhaktanam Mana Vardhanaha. So, Kardama was honored by Kapila, increasing his fame, increasing his honor by appearing as his son. By distributing Sankhya, Kapila would increase the honor of the devotees. Semicolon. Therefore, Sankhya philosophy is not dry mental speculation. Sankhya philosophy means devotional service. How could the honor of the devotees be increased unless Sankhya was meant for devotional service? Yes? Devotees are not interested in speculative knowledge, therefore the Sankhya enunciated by Kapila is meant to establish one firmly in devotional service. Real knowledge and real liberation is to surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and engage in devotional service. So, he's come to disseminate the process of real knowledge, which is devotional service. This, I guess, is pretty simple. But it's not, he doesn't add another paragraph, which he could easily have done, to say, then there's this atheist Kapila that hits the delete button when it comes to devotional service. It's real knowledge, not for knowing the personality of Godhead and engaging in this devotional service. It's real knowledge to become one with Brahman. But the verse says, you know, you've come to increase the honor of the bhaktas. Which means his Sankhya philosophy is to bring one to bhakti, otherwise it wouldn't be increasing the honor and glory of the devotees. Okay. Took me a while when going through this, just appreciating the way that Prabhupada has composed the purport. Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschachadi. Prabhupada is just fulfilling his mandate or his mission or his gift to protect the reader of the Bhagavatam and encourage those who want to come to the message of Bhagavatam to understand the message is devotional service, the message is not impersonalism. And the other Kapila teaches impersonalism, and that's not what Kapila is saying, what Kardama is saying here about Kapila. You increase the fame of your devotee because you teach devotional service. Okay, anyway. Text 31. My dear Lord, I'm saying it again, he's talking to his son. My dear Lord, you have material form, although you have no material form, you have your own innumerable forms. They truly are your transcendental forms, which are pleasing to your devotees. The purport here is a little intricate, so you have to pay attention. Don't get lazy. Sit, you know, be very attentive and a little intricate. In the Brahma Samhita, it is stated that the Lord is one, absolute, but he has ananta or innumerable forms. Advaita Machuta Manadi Mananta Rupam. The Lord is the original form, but still he has multi-forms. Those multi-forms are manifested by him transcendentally according to the tastes of his multi-devotees. It is understood that once Hanuman, the great devotee of Lord Ramachandra, said that he knew that Narayana, the husband of Lakshmi, and Rama, the husband of Sita, are one and the same, and that there is no difference between Lakshmi and Sita, but as for himself, he liked the form of Lord Ram. In a similar way, some devotees worship the original form of Krishna. When we say Krishna, quote, we refer to all forms of the Lord, not only Krishna, but Ramana, Sringa, Narayana, etc. The varieties of transcendental forms exist simultaneously. That is also stated in Brahma Samhita. Ramadi Murchasho, Ramadi Murchashu, Nanavataram, various avatars. He, Krishna, exists in multi-forms, but none of the forms are material. Sridhar Swami has commented that Rupinaha, it's in the verse, text 31, Arupinaha, or without form, means without material form. The Lord has form, otherwise how can it be stated here? Tanyeva, te, abhirupani, rupani, bhagavans, tava, quote, you have your forms, but they are not material. Materially, you have no form, but spiritually, transcendentally, you have multi-forms. My philosophies can't understand these transcendental forms of the Lord, and being disappointed, they say, the Supreme Lord is impersonal. But that is not the fact. Whenever there is form, there's a person. Many times in Vedic literature, the Lord is described as Purusha, which means, quote, the original form, the original enjoyer, unquote. The conclusion is that the Lord has no material form, and yet, according to the liking of different grades of devotees, he simultaneously exists in multi-forms, such as Rama, Nrisimha, Varaha, Narayana, and Mukunda. There are many thousands and thousands of forms, but they are all Vishnu Tattva, comma, Krishna. Who knows what somebody would conclude without the Bhaktivedanta purports? Like fireworks on the 4th of July. This means that, and on and on. So, again and again, we're cautioned, don't hear from unscrupulous commentators or Bhagavad Katha reciters and so forth. My thoughts are going to a wealthy man that lived in Harrisburg, probably still lives in Harrisburg, and he liked the devotees very much. He even invited Pushkar to come to his home and make a big mural on his big ceiling of his big living room, or along the upper portion of the ceiling, of Rasalila. He's, you know, a bhakta. But he shared one time, we were visiting from Gita Nagari, I'm a materialist. I mean, I have some spiritual inclination, but it for me to really appreciate Krishna Bhakti, the elements have to be right. Like, you know, charming and well done and the kirtan and the everything. Because otherwise, materialistic persons like me, although there's a devotee side of me, there's a material side of me, and the elements have to be right. Otherwise, it doesn't hold my attention because I have this material side of me. So the reason I'm bringing that up is the attractiveness of Krishna is innately all attractive from the spiritual perspective. And the pastimes are so wonderful and amazing that it's, in one sense, easy to captivate the attention of a person like this gentleman or a child or people in between. Krishna is all attractive. It's what his name means, the all-attractive person. But for some people that have a strain of enjoying material facilities, yeah, thank you very much. Some persons who have a tendency for enjoying material facilities, they can't enjoy Krishna without it. You know, like, prasadam is prasadam. But, you know, what's your favorite prasadam? When we had our GBC meeting recently in Ujjain, there was what everybody, you know, the prasadam that was prepared in quantity for our meals, and over there was the tray of Mahaprasadam. And, you know, I'd like some of that and some of that. You know, the favorite, whatever your favorite is. Bhaktisiddhanta had the habit of, he would just take things and merge it all together. And so, you know, there wasn't any, I like this. Anyway. Because he wanted to demonstrate, of course there's difference of tastes, that's why we don't make differences of our offerings to Krishna, but we're not Krishna, and we're attracted to the material aspect of something, the material aspect of kirtan, or the material aspect of katha, or whatever, the material aspect of something, the deity dressing, instead of making just this wonderful offering to the deity because it's for the pleasure of the deity. There's a risk in this the Yukta Vairagya principle, that is, we can engage wealth in service to Krishna. And now it's authorized, so we can become attracted to the wealth or the opulence. And then when the wealth or opulence isn't gone, then bhakti's gone. Because bhakti wasn't there to begin with. If it's were more attracted to the opulence than to the mood of devotion. You get the idea. The prasadam, as long as it's prepared by a special, like really good cook, and then we're attracted and otherwise not attracted. So Bhakti said to mix the preparations, so he wouldn't, for showing example, that it's not about our taste, it's about Krishna's taste. And we make the nicest of offerings, but it's not about our liking of some element or another. Now there's certainly nothing wrong with appreciating, oh, this cook has prepared something very nicely for Krishna. But, you know, it's for Krishna. That's the bhakti principle. So in the whole description of Lord Kapiladev, since there is this atheistic modern Kapila fellow, again and again, it's of necessity that Prabhupada is making a distinction between the bhakti Kapila and the impersonal Kapila, or the bhakti process and the impersonal process. He's holding us by the hand and taking us to the bhakti process again and again, and making the distinction otherwise. The verse is saying, once again, you have your own innumerable forms, although you have no material form. They, these innumerable forms, are your transcendental forms which are pleasing to your devotees. In one sense, it's easy to understand how impersonalists reach the wrong conclusion. Not guided by a devotee, when they see there's multi forms of the Lord, well, there's got to be something behind the forms that's what's really spiritual, the impersonal within. And so the form and the pastimes and the exchanges are not as important as the impersonal foundation of those forms. I mean, it's understandable how they can reach that conclusion by faulty logic or by not having the proper guidance of the innumerable forms of the Lord. So Brahma Samhita is being referred to. These innumerable forms of the Lord are forms of one original form. And within that one original form, all of the other forms are there, and the other forms are manifest as a plenary portion of that original form. We would be really lost without the disciplic succession and revealing these things. For us, it's made really easy. And we will meet people that haven't had that good fortune, and they'll reach another conclusion. And the variety of conclusions people can reach is practically without limit. Therefore, these kinds of explanations within purport, so that we're prepared. If we read very carefully, not only because we're faithful to our founder Acharya and therefore we're not led astray from our founder Acharya because we're faithful to him, but we can also, he's preparing us to become beyond Majjhimas, he prepares us to become Uttamas by giving these clarifications again and again and again. So that when we do meet somebody that's confused, and we certainly meet people that are confused, having not heard in disciplic succession. If we've read carefully Prabhupada's book, we can guide them to Krishna, or guide them to a proper understanding of that form of the Lord which they have a preference for. This is one of Krishna's forms. And we don't have to necessarily each time go through A to Z with a new person or someone that has a particular liking of a form of the Lord. But we should be clear within ourselves, and if called upon, to establish what's the scriptural foundation for why we accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Whether that's something else or someone else, or Brahman. So we're not just sentimentalists, we're in firm ground of scripture. I remember Prabhupada saying that a devotee should be equipped like a lawyer is equipped. The lawyer is equipped by study of the law books and cases, court cases, so that if called upon, he can say, you know, in case such and such, immediately he can draw upon case such and such. This is the conclusion of the higher court. So a devotee should be like that. They should be so conversant, like a lawyer. He can argue his case. It doesn't mean the other side is going to be convinced by your argument, but he should be, the devotee should be very clear about why we're doing what we're doing. Let's spend a little bit of time with one more point and then end. Recently, just before coming to Detroit, I was being driven somewhere by a nice young Russian devotee who is interacting with people who aren't devotees of Krishna, and they are, as he's presenting the message of Krishna consciousness, he's asked different questions from people that have different faith, and he wanted to know how to answer some of those questions. And particularly, Prabhupada equipped us, if we become carefully read and carefully contemplate what he's written, how to deal with people that don't come from India. You know, his preaching to the world, specifically to the Western population, that was the mandate from his spiritual master. And so read carefully, and we're equipped with those answers, how to respond to people, because Prabhupada was addressing people that didn't have the Vedic paradigm. They weren't from India. Now, people that are from India, they have a whole other set of ideas about what the Vedic paradigm is and isn't. But Western people, who we're supposed to be reaching out to, that's the mandate of Bhaktisiddhanta de Prabhupada, who we're supposed to be assisting, it's important to know how to respond to this question or that doubt or this attachment or this concern or whatever. It's there in Prabhupada's books. So just to address one of them that this young Russian devotee was asking. How is one to determine out of the options out there in the spiritual marketplace what's authorized, what's authentic? Because there's lots of things that are not. But how do you know when you got a new person and they're inquisitive, they want to know. They're not just dogmatists. They want to know, how do I discern? How do I discriminate between something that's genuine and something that's not? A teaching that's authentic or authorized. Within you know, the purview of the Vedas and different disciplines following the Vedas, or otherwise, non-Vedic. How do I know what's authentic? What's the litmus test for authenticity? So I shared with this nice devotee one example. In Gita Nagari, or near Gita Nagari, there's a Mormon elder. There's not only Amish, there's a Mormon elder. And that Mormon elder, every summer, receives about 20 youth. You know, the 2 years that they go and do the mission of the Mormon Church. And because he's an elder, they come to his place and they spend time with him. And this Mormon elder, I don't know if he still does it, but was bringing the Mormon youth to Gita Nagari, because that's part of what they do. They experience other traditions and in such a way that it nourishes their faith in their tradition. So, on one occasion, I met with a group of them, and I was just sitting around with a group of them. So the discussion went to how the Mormon faith started and where it is today. So I shared with them that I grew up in upstate New York, and maybe 5 or 6 times I, with my family, we went to Palmyra, New York, which is in western New York State, between Buffalo and Rochester. And we attended the Mormon pageant. The Mormon pageant is, purportedly at least, the very hill or mini mountain that Joseph Smith went up and got teachings from God and came back down and said, "Here's the teaching that God gave me." And they said, "Oh, you attended the Mormon pageant. What was it like?" And described what it was like. And then I said, I asked them a question, saying, "How do you know that the teaching that Joseph Smith got from God is the same thing that you're getting today?" Just speaking of your disciplic succession. But I asked the question that way. Well, he said, "Because the elders in Salt Lake, you know, they're preserving the teachings of Joseph Smith with great care and integrity." I said, "Let's go one step further. How do you know that what the elders in Salt Lake are telling you is the teachings of Joseph Smith, is the teachings of Joseph Smith? Like, you know, there were some elders before them, and some elders before them, and some elders before them. And over a period of passage of time, how do you know the same teachings today are what the teachings that Joseph Smith received?" I wasn't questioning Joseph Smith, I was questioning disciplic succession. And they said, "Well, we just accept the elders." He said, "I'm not asking you to weaken your faith in the elders. I'm suggesting that you look at the writings of the previous elders and the previous elders and the previous elders and examine, have there been changes? Just like when I was little, I read the Bible. And then I went to college and there's some things that got changed in the Bible, like the commandments. I don't know what happened, but you know, and then I found out what happened. But it used to be thou shalt not kill, and then it became thou shalt not murder. And that's because of the strong influence of Eastern teaching that says when you take the life of an animal, it's killing. So it got, the language got changed. The commandments language got changed from kill to murder, because murder means people, and killing of animals, that's not murder. You know, showed strong influence of Eastern religion, made a change in the Bible. I mean, not all Bibles change, but King James Version, first, the one that I grew up with as a kid, it changed. And I go, like, wow. So that happened even in the span of my short lifetime, what to speak of, you know, since Joseph Smith was around. So I recommend, you don't have to do this, but I recommend that you go in back of the annals of the elders and the writings of, in our case, it's our previous acharyas, and the teaching that I'm getting from my spiritual master, the teachings of the previous acharyas. And if there's a one-to-one correlation, fine. And if it's not, you're not getting Joseph Smith's teachings from God. You're getting somebody else's version. And that's not, so it's just, it's the principle of disciplic succession. You know, left it at that. But we have, the purpose of a dialogue with such people is not, you know, to grab them from that ism over to this ism. Some may want to do that, I don't know, but that's not the purpose. The purpose is to help people become authentic in their practice. And if they're not receiving the original teachings, that's just the reason we're bringing this up, is it's what is in Prabhupada's these two purports. The atheistic kapila is not kapila. Because the kapila that Kardama is the father of, he's appreciating that, you know, you expand the fame of your devotees because of the teachings of bhakti, although it's knowledge, Sankhya philosophy, expanding the glories of your devotees, because that Sankhya philosophy leads to bhakti, not to something else. And through bhakti, understanding the personality of God, which is what the previous three verses that we discussed yesterday was about. The other processes fall short. They don't have the same capacity to understand Krishna in full. Fortunate for you all, here in this area, you have a very nice center that is very effective in reaching the non-Indian population in the area. And there's another nice center that's very effective in reaching the Indian population in the area. We're equal opportunity organization. And of the two, Prabhupada was keen in reaching the American, because now people that are born in India are now literally American, just like many people living in America were previously from Europe, and now a whole lot of people previously from China, and a whole lot of people previously from South America, and a whole lot of people previously from Africa. So, you know, but we're for everyone, not just for people that previously were from India. So it takes a little extra work and strategy, and but it's something our founder Acharya wanted. So we should want what our founder Acharya wanted and help one another fulfill the desire of our founder Acharya. It's not that Prabhupada didn't want people from India to become part of the Hare Krishna movement here in America. He wanted, however, the English-speaking parts of the world to pick. Anyway, so we need to work together and make special plans and special efforts and special strategies and funding of those efforts to bring Krishna consciousness to the other populations in America besides the non-resident Indians. I mean, you all know this, and it's like easy to not do anything about it, and it's a little extra effort to do something about it, and we need to help one another make plans and strategies and execute those plans and strategies and become more effective in this area. Fortunately for you, to say it again, there is a nice center that's doing that wonderfully. Could do it better. And it could be more, not just one center does it and the rest of us does the other thing. I'm sure you talk about it locally. I know your GBC has strong feelings about it because there's just some recent exchange on this in our GBC, North American GBC conference. We need to reach out to people and be prepared to help people make a step and another step and another step towards Krishna Bhakti from diverse backgrounds. Besides the low-hanging fruit, easy ones, we should feel the weight and responsibility and dedication to do that. Not just the people over there in Ypsilanti. That's what they do. And it's for all of us, myself included. For the pleasure of our founder, Acharya. And it has its practical benefits as well as the practical requirements to do it. Anyway, things are moving in that direction, so I'm just tooting the horn a little bit. Any discussion? Kind of covered a lot of different areas. Yes?
Thank you, Maharaj, for the two questions. Is there a place where we have, like, you shared this, your experience with a group of people, how you share from that, how the disciplic succession is that? So we have these general questions which we come across when we meet people. Is there a place or a book compiled for preaching to the preachers or how to tackle these situations? Anything compiled like that? Like, we have perfect questions, perfect answers by the Prabhupada, but other than that, is there any? Yes, because these are general questions like which we have devotees.
There must be, but I'm not aware. Is anybody in the room aware of a resource that, like, he's asking about?
There's a book written by Keshavananda Prabhu, Answering the Atheist. He was listening and recently shared a book. It's about answering such questions. There's a book by Chaitanya Charan Prabhu about spiritual material questions and answers, which people commonly ask about preaching.
That's different than what he's asking about. It's in the direction of
preachers.
But, specifically, at least what I understood the question to be, people, Caucasian Americans or, non-resident Indian Americans, and the types of questions that they have, doubts, concerns, and is there a manual or some writing that helps us understand when questions arise, how to respond to those questions that they bring up? That's what I understood your question to be.
Yes, Maharaj. So, a practical example is like one time one devotee brought a poor Christian couple, elderly couple to the temple, introducing them to our philosophy, but they are very religious and like they go
closed.
How to introduce our philosophy and then like, because like when we try to speak to them, we try to bombard with them with our.
So
this is where we face challenges. Like very nicely you shared with us, how you try to connect them to say not ridiculing their faith or their practices, but you just directed them, like, you know, look into this and then, like, you know, derive your...
Yeah.
So that would definitely help for pregnant people when we speak with these...
I'm inspired by your question. Meaning, once again, as it happens, you know, it seems like in waves, once again there's a wave of concern in North America particularly that we're not doing what we should be doing. And so with that wave requesting a good writer or a team to compile such a manual, how to help people go from, you know, zero to two, so they're not feeling uncomfortable, and how to go to, from two to ten. And anyway, something that's addresses your question, a resource that you that persons that get the message and want some help. It's kind of like, how do you learn book distribution? Well, you invite Vaisheshika Prabhu and you learn book distribution. And it's easy. It's fun. And it, you know, it's not intimidating. It's blissful. And it's real, you know, one, two, three. So, like that, somebody, some resource that can then take somebody that wants to go down this path and fulfill something that will help them. I'm intrigued by your question. I don't know where it's going to go next, but you want to add to this?
I think there's an old book by Satyaraj Prabhu, Christ and Krishna.
Yeah.
That was the last book I could think of, like, which is...
Yeah.
Kind of
yeah.
How to preach to those people.
Yeah. Well, it he doesn't do that, but it's a resource.
Yeah. Conversation.
Yeah. Om Shalom, another. You know, it's interfaith dialogue. Vegetarianism.
My second question yesterday, I wanted to ask you, like, in the beginning you talked about Paramatma and Bhagavan, and you mentioned that once in Goloka, what happens to Paramatma. It's a trying to understand, like, so when the soul travels from one body to another, so the Paramatma goes with the soul, but when he attains the perfection and goes back to the Goloka Vrindavan, so the Paramatma is not there, but because you have Bhagavan picture and
yes.
Directly engaged in the service of the Lord in the Goloka, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yes. When attention is turned away from Bhagavan, Bhagavan very kindly hides himself in the heart of living entity as Paramatma, who accompanies the living entity, and then job well done when he goes back to Godhead. So he, you know, the Paramatma feature exists within the material creation, not in the spiritual domain. Yes.
Thank you very much for class, wonderful class. One question on the, two questions, two part question. And when you describe sentimentalism, how do we understand to what degree our attraction is based on sentimentalism versus true attraction? And then how do we divert that attraction from sentimentalism to true attraction?
Well, unsteady bhakti is a sign of sentimentalism. When conditions are right, I'm attracted. When conditions aren't right, I'm not attracted. The unsteadiness of bhakti. And there are different, you know, subsets of that one. When things go bad, or I don't get what I want, or someone treats me harshly or something, then you'll... So, steadiness in bhakti is when there's no material cause or no material impediment. Yeah? Ahaitokiya pratyata. So, worrying that you're, you know, in differing degrees, even for an individual, at different times, different degrees of sentimentalism. When there's no material cause or no material impediment, that's then, otherwise there's some degree. Now, the second part is how to get from the sentimentalism to pure. That's second part. Cultivation. One of the questions we heard yesterday was, I like the language very much. A continuation of refinement and realignment towards unmixed devotion. It's not just, you know, a one-time thing or an occasional thing, but it's a continual thing. The exercise of refining, realigning towards with humility, with good association. So we can get some feedback about, you know, how we're doing. It could be good peer association or good senior association or combination, but good association. Seeking out those who will give us honest feedback, not just pats on the back, but honest feedback, and not, you know, that's just critical, but honest feedback, encouragement, and good association. And an ongoing, from our side, an ongoing desire to come to the real deal. Like Bhaktisiddhanta's, one of his writings is Search for Truth, series of essays. And it's an ongoing process. Search for truth with a capital T. That's our, you know, being situated in our relationship with Krishna that's not supported by and based upon my autobiography, my guna and karma, and accepting, rejecting on that basis. But, you know, sincere desire for truth with a capital T. So it's a long project. So if that goal is very clear, I want to come to that stage, then stay with it. The series of refinements, because it's, you know, we get a little complacent and we're off the middle of the road again, doing, you know, distracted activity instead of very focused activity for the pleasure of Krishna. Or as the question was, you know, we go too far into the rules and away from the bhakti principle. Good association. Renewing again and again our commitment to the goal. Being very clear what the goal is, renewing again and again, and refining how we're taking the next step and next step, and not be lazy. It's easy to be lazy.
Too easy.
Complacency. Yeah.
Yesterday I had a humbling experience, and I'd like to share that experience.
Okay.
And then seek advice on one aspect.
Hmm.
I spoke some harsh words to
somebody,
and they're not practicing devotees. And one of them later wrote to me expressing how they were upset, and they didn't think it was appropriate. And they made the statement that they're disappointed knowing that I'm a devotee, and I did that. So I went to them and apologized, and I apologized profusely actually, and they accepted the apology. But I mean, the most saddening thing for me was that I didn't properly represent Prabhupada in that, and I knew immediately after I had done it. I felt it within myself that I had made a mistake. So I apologized, and the relationship is all right now. But I was thinking more about the statement she made that, you know, I'm disappointed in you, despite being a devotee, you're acting like this or speaking like this. And I was thinking that, yes, I need to always be aware of how I'm representing Prabhupada. But
yeah.
I'm also conditioned. And I was thinking that it's fine for now it's okay, I've fixed the relationship, but if somebody is always looking at others who are trying to progress spiritually and judging them to be perfect, it can cause trouble for them and, you know, in the future relationships. So I was trying to understand whether or not I should say something to her about this. Like, not assuming that people who are doing, you know, devotional or any kind of spiritual practice, or, you know, you make an assumption that they're supposed to be perfect all the time. Should I actually say something to her? And if so, how to say it in a way that, you know, it doesn't have adverse effects, you know? And because one of the fears I've always had is that I'm going to do something or say something to someone, and it's gonna turn them away from Krishna and Prabhupada instead of take them to what I never wanna do that. It's a question to you.
Well, different individuals are different because that's the individuality. And what I might do in a situation like that might be different than what another person would do in a situation like that, and different than yet another person. I would personally encourage you to consider this is a good exercise of learning for you, more than it is an exercise of repairing the damage to the other person. You know, and then the damage to the other person can be helped by, you know, learning a lesson that it goes deep enough that it's less likely to happen again. Doesn't guarantee it's not going to happen again, but less likely. By, you know, investing and investing and investing in the relationship. Just, you know, to help you or me learn this isn't okay. I don't want to do it again. So, and I definitely don't want this person to be, you know, damaged, although now they say it's okay. We know how human nature is. Of course, different persons are different, but often people remember the blemish, although they may have forgiven. And so, for your own edification and purification. Think of different, make a little list or brainstorm with another devotee so it's a nice robust list, and then select from the list of over a period of the next while, a month or something, that from time to time you engage in some conversation with this person that shows that, you know, you're deeply repentant. And, you know, it's not really who you are. It was, you know, in the deeper sense of who you are. It's part of your imperfection that you're striving to get on the other side of. And I can think of some things right off the top of what could be done. And you could even share with the person, depending upon the relationship and the person. I want to get on the other side of this, where I don't do with others as I've done with you. I'm feeling deeply remorseful. And so, may I have your permission? Please help me. And, you know, so, and I would like to share some things with you, and it's just for my edification, purification, and I don't want this to happen again. Is that okay with you? Or, you know, maybe, depending upon the person. Is this a person you periodically or even regularly interact with?
I regularly interact with them, but I won't after 3 weeks.
Okay. Well, then, if the person is the kind of person that says, yeah, you know, I'll be a guinea pig for you, sure. I'll help you, get on the other side of this thing happening again. That's okay. That's okay. They can say no. Or you can do it, you don't have to have that discussion with them. You can just do it on your own. And share different things. Here's a gift. Or there was a situation, just share just different anecdotes. One that comes to mind is Prabhupada was approached by an American lady who said, you know, appreciation, some of your followers, they don't represent you well, appreciation. And then Prabhupada responded saying, thank you for your appreciation. And as far as my followers that don't represent me well, please understand that they recognize that they're not clean, but they're trying to become clean. Like a person that's in the shower trying to become clean because they know they're not clean. And then thank you for your appreciation. So with that in mind, my dear acquaintance, I've learned an important lesson. And I'm again seeking your forgiveness because I recognize that I'm not clean. And I wish to become clean. And I'm feeling deeply repentant. Because I'm not representing others properly. I'm still in this space that's, you know, I'm trying, but I'm not there yet. So I'm just sharing that with you because it's still gnawing away at me. You've forgiven me, and I'm not so good at forgiving myself yet because I don't want this to happen again. So I'm sharing this with you. You know, so please don't hold, the organization to be like that behavior that was unbecoming, and I'm feeling deeply remorseful over that. I just wanted to share that with you, and you know, in the 2 weeks that you're with that person, so you can consider. And the purpose I'm doing this is not to change your mind. The purpose is my purification. whatever you're going to feel, you're going to feel. And I hope you don't feel badly toward the organization because of my behavior the other day. Because our organization doesn't represent the organization, doesn't represent the teachings, doesn't represent my teachers. It represents, you know, the contamination that's I'm carrying with me as I'm trying to become pure. So, and even if you don't do that, any either one of those two things, with seek permission from them or just invest, consider different ways. It's something like what Prabhupada writes in Bhagavad Gita purport that if you to fix the mind upon Krishna, consider different ways of spreading Krishna consciousness even if you don't do it. You know, you connect with the mood of Krishna's compassion upon conditioned souls and you connect with that. Consider different ways of spreading Krishna consciousness and it'll help fix the mind. Even if just contemplating what I might do if there was more time or if there was more willingness or a different kind of a relationship or something. Stay with it for the purpose of not minimizing the chance of its repeating. Yeah? Yes? About
the risk, there's a risk in applying the principle of Yukta Vairagya.
Yukta Vairagya.
So you were giving that example of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj about the taste of the food and he would mix it and so that bring the principle that it's for Krishna's pleasure, it's not for our pleasure. I also was thinking that it depends upon individuals how we take it, like there's a risk in that also. That
yes.
We can go in the impersonal side of it. That.
And you can go into the pride to see how I'm detached. That's not a cookie cutter religion or response. He was doing things in a certain way for a certain purpose.
And that can open someone's heart. Like sometimes I feel like when I hear that, this feels like probably it might not be for me if I were to think that way. It feels very hard, that behavior. As if I have to negate my taste and say that. It's not okay to have a taste.
It's not?
It's not okay to have a certain affinity for a certain kind of taste.
Yeah, sure. It's natural. And the razor's edge is do it for Krishna. And that's where the introspection is required. It can be rebellion or it can be impersonalism or it can be all kinds of things. And whatever it is, the bottom line or the measure to evaluate is anukulyena. Is this being done for the pleasure of Krishna? Whether it's this or that or something else. Well, however, is my response coming from a place of wanting to please Krishna? Or wanting to feel good about myself or something other? I'm looking at the clock, and I think it's time to end. We'll take one more question. Oops, two more questions.
You spoke about, give the example of a liar, how he should be. He reads all the books and be ready with available for the argument or explain things. So how can
Prabhupada said it? Yeah.
So how can we read Prabhupada books to become like that? It's most of it. I read irregularly, but even when I read, I forget most of the things.
Mm-hmm. Well, two responses. One is training helps you be more disciplined in how you're reading. And another is, have you had the experience? Probably the answer is yes. that when you're in a situation, you're called upon to respond to someone's question or doubt. All this understanding that you read long ago just comes to your mind. Supersoul just supplies remembrance of something that you heard or read or understood, and then you wonder, wow, where'd that come from? If I tried to sit down and remember that, I wouldn't be able to remember that. You follow? So, the sincerity of how you apply yourself to the process of hearing, reading, receiving, that's critical. That's really, really, really important. Do it carefully. And some people have better memories, some people have medium memories, some people have poor memories. So try to capture the essence as you're going along. Okay?
I was wondering, when Krishna left this planet, it's mentioned that he left a material body here.
Long story.
So I was wondering, it's mentioned in this verse that he doesn't have a material form. So how do you understand those things together?
When visiting Dwarka last year, we visited the place where Krishna left, and there's exhaustive, I mean not like a lot, it's exhaustive commentary from our acharyas on this point. And just to keep it really simple, Krishna is fulfilling the desires of everyone. For the devotee, oh, how wonderful is my Krishna that he did this. And for the non-devotee, just see Krishna's material and everything in between. He could have so many things. You know, but the logic of it, you get hit in the heel with an arrow. You don't die. And then hit in the heel with an arrow and he died and left a material body. I mean, so just see. For the materialists or the impersonalists. And for the devotee, just see how wonderful is my Krishna. And there's, again, there's a lot of commentary by our acharyas on that pastime. Hare Krishna. Prabhupada ki jai.